Hey, did you guys hear the joke about Null?
Hey, Daniel Markham here with another Nerd Roundup.
Hey, if you've never been to a Nerd Roundup, what happens is once a week we drop by, and anybody, my friends that can come by the room, and we talk about cool stories from the past week. I tag them as I see them during the week, and my friends are welcome to bring others. We can just do whatever we want to do. I think a team that has fun together can do damn near anything together. And I tell you, I'm really rocking on this new Discord server we've got up. And I tell you why. Because it's not like Facebook. It's not like Twitter. It's more like a place where you just kind of go and hang out. And that leads to interactive and creative conversations. Greg Young and I this morning were talking about dependencies and packaging and events and all of that led to another chat, real-time voice chat, and that was about types of platforms and really cool categories of software development, and that probably will lead to an essay, and then Greg and I have talked about putting some hard metrics around that and turning it into something a little more teethy instead of just strategic. So I am here by myself, and I believe it is my deodorant, either that or my toothpaste. I need to switch these things so people can show up. No, I don't think it's that. If my breath is so bad, you can smell it from 1,000 miles away. I need a new planet or something. I had four friends text me or email me in the last day saying they couldn't make it and they're very sorry. So we have anywhere between, I think I've had as many six people online and probably half a dozen times I've had just me. And another half dozen started with me and people drop by during the chat. So it kind of mixes up. The more people we have, usually, the less we talk about anything in the link list, which is fine. And the less people we have, usually the quicker we go through it. So since it's just me, I imagine today will be about a half hour or so. And there are some really, really super cool links. And this week, like many weeks, somehow or another, we ended up with a theme. I don't do themes. I just, you know, tag links and see them through the week that I'm interested in, and then I collate and rank them and show them to my friends. So I don't actually go out saying, oh, this week I want to do something about event sourcing. Nope, just whatever's interesting to me. This week, however, we have a theme, and I'll see if you guys can figure out what it is as we go through. Okie dokie. This first article is called C++ Exceptions Are Becoming More and More Problematic. C++ is the language that's been around since the world was formed from the void, and I imagine will be around for another billion years or so. It is big honking, does everything computer programming language. I love C++. I've coded in C++ in commercial production. I would never code in C++ again. It is the ultimate, the epitome of Swiss Army knives of programming. You want to do functional programming, you can. You want to do OO, you can. You can do procedural. Any kind of way you want to code, C++ will let you do it. One of the reasons I like C++ so much is that it is so open to everything that it forces developers and development shops to tighten down exactly what they're going to do and not do in the code base. So this is, hey dudes, this is saying that the exception handling is becoming more and more problematic. Why, you might ask? Well, it's a good thing you asked. The fact is C++ is a language developed for single processors from, I think it was the early 80s when Bjorn Strusset wrote it. And we're not doing those single processors anymore. So we're actually doing multiprocessor cloud programming. And when you have a single processor-oriented language, it's a big honking thing like C++ is, and you throw an exception, well, you got to go back to whoever called you and tell them what went wrong. And what went wrong can be a very complicated thing to tell people if you run all over the damn place. Single processor, no problem. You just keep track of the stack in the local heap, and you send it back to the caller, and they either barf on it or send it up another level or do something with it. This becomes very useful in a single processor situation. If you guys have ever done a debugging session, you can look at all the variables. It's very, very cool. But if you've got 50 processors running around the world, you can't do that. And one of the things they bring up in this article is that the way they do exception handling is they dynamically allocate the memory. And they have to. There's no way around it. So if you're going down this class tree, you're instantiating all these classes, You may have 14 different parent classes and you're holding a bunch of structs. So maybe you're holding some classes yourself and suddenly, you know, something goes wrong. Well, all of those things you have created dynamically in memory as you have created that structure. And it may be a different structure the next time you create the same type of class, same object. You don't know. And so your state as a CPU running this language, having an exception, is infinitely different than somebody else's state doing the same thing in a different country, perhaps. You just don't know. So you can't just send back, you got to send back this huge honking thing, and it's getting bigger and bigger and harder to actually do, and it's just not working. Like the guy says, it is problematic. He introduces it very well here. He suggests three different answers. He suggests a standard expected, which is sort of like a promise or a contract. Boost has a leaf. It caches by value, which is also kind of cool. And then he's just throwing values directly. They also do some experimentation with local tree. This is just a gnarly, gnarly problem. And at the end of the paper, they basically said, beats me. And I'm with them because I don't think there's anything you can do here that's not just going to make it uglier than it already is. So cool paper, C++ exceptions, not going to work moving forward. And, you know, I'm interested in how Java and C# and other folks have solved this problem. I know how the OCaml folks are doing it because they've been blogging about it a lot. It's the returning types. Golly gee, what is it? Oh, it's the union valued exceptions. That's how Campbell's doing it. But the .NET folks, I think if I'm not correct, the .NET folks are instantiating their own sort of logging error handling system, which, you know, it's weird because when you're working in a cloud environment, you're almost everything you do is both doing the thing and logging the thing because you're having to go over a wire or across a CPU boundary. And so it becomes quite fluffy and indistinct where the boundaries between those things are. By the way, this is the conversation Greg and I had this morning. C++ exceptions becoming more and more problematic. Next article, Nikon explains why the Z9 ditches the mechanical shutter. I was hugely interested in this, and you guys who are not camera nerds probably are not. But it is a tech story. If you don't know, the way we have cameras set the way we have today is because of the film industry. And it used to be we'd just take a picture, you'd stick your head under a hood, and you'd raise a curtain up, and then you'd lower it, and everybody had to sit still. Well, when you started doing movies, they had to take a bunch of pictures really fast. And they're like, okay, they first invented film that could take pictures really fast. That was cool. I think Eastman Kodak did that. And then they said, well, how do we take pictures fast? We just can't, like, flapping up the thing. We can't, like, you know, swap guys out every 10 seconds. What they decided to do was have a shutter that flips up and flips down and controls the exposure of the picture. And this is both the way we did film cameras and the way we ended up with DSLRs today. And it's a really cool thing because what it does is it compresses the idea of catching the image into a series of things that are all distinct and important. Shutter speed, sensitivity of film, aperture, focal length, all those stuff are different depending what those settings are. So what they ended up doing by making pictures happen really fast is mechanically sort of doing the analysis on how do you take a picture, any kind of picture, and you adjust the different settings on the same scene to get different pictures. Well, DSLRs, as you know, we've been transitioning from film to digital, and DSLRs have kept the shutter around. People are like, well, gee, why can't you go and, you know, just use a no-shutter camera. I think Fujika has one of those. Well, the thing is that if you have it open all the time, you no longer have an event called a picture. You just have a stream of photons coming in that you have to process. And that's, to be frank, no problem if you're just out honking around taking a picture of your lunch. It becomes more of a problem if you want to have an artistic control over what the photo looks like. So up until now, serious quote-unquote photographers have used cameras, even if they're digital, that have all these mechanical parts, because all those little mechanical parts do important things that could not be done electronically. Well, this has changed. This is a big deal. With the Z9, Nikon's getting rid of the shutter. And the reason why is really cool. The reason why their scan rate on the back pain, the sensitivity has gotten so fast that they're actually continuously taking pictures as they go along, I mean, like hundreds of times a second, such that there's no difference. They just grab one set of pixels off at 1,000th, I guess it would be probably 4,000th of a second. And it's like you're taking 4,000 pictures a second electronically. And that's just honking wild. So you can expect to see more and more of this. This is an amazing advance in technology. Okay, this next one's from Diego. Hey, Diego, see you in the chat room here. Physicists build circuit that generates clean, limitless power. I think we've finally done it. You know, for a long time, we've been trying to create perpetual motion machines. I think what we've done instead is create a system of creating perpetual motion machine claims. We do that all the time. this is actually more solid than I thought it was at first. When Diego sent it to me, I'm like, another sort of clean energy ultimate kind of stuff. What they're actually saying is at the atomic level, they can convert thermal radiation, thermal activity into very, very, very small amounts of current. Now, this is still a big, big claim. Feynman said, you can't do this. It's not going to happen. You violate some causality stuff. It's just, but they thought, maybe we can make it happen. And turns out they could. And they're generating microscopic levels of current. Maybe useful for converting like ambient heat into, just a very, very small circuit. This is not going to power your car. And part of the reason is once you start stacking this, you've taken the thermal activity out of the air. It doesn't stack. We can't mass produce it. There's a million reasons why this is never going to work at scale. But it may scale up to the point where you get some microvolts out enough to run something. That'd be pretty cool. By the way, this isn't the only ambient energy device they're talking about. Another one that uses Wi-Fi. And I think there's one that actually uses the electromagnetic radiation from household current through the air to charge. So we're kind of getting small enough with our electronics that we can pull out very, very tiny amounts of radiation from the environment and use that to power stuff. And it's kind of wild. It makes you wonder if we couldn't create sort of, what do they call it, this intelligent dust? Little specks of electronics that pull energy from the air and talk to one another in a cloud formation. That's freaking scary, actually. Cool stuff. Thank you, Diego. This next one I was hoping Greg would stop by for. Greg, I'm going to come bust you in the head, dude. The different types of event-driven systems. I read this, I'm like, Greg, yo, event-driven systems. This is right down your alley. And he went off and gave me this big response, and it was very, very cool. This guy says, hey, if you're doing event processing, message queues, there are three different types of events. And I'm guilty of writing, there are three different blah, 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 as much as the next guy. So I laughed both at the author and myself when he wrote, there are only three things here, because I'm that guy. He says the three types of event are domain event, trigger or signal event, and the restful or fat event. It's an exciting story down here, and he's got the class, and he's got the upsides and downsides of each of the three. He personally likes restful or fat events. This is so much to go into. If you'll notice that the signal event really kind of gets back to just kind of logging. The difference between signaling that somebody purchased something and logging that a purchase was made, it's almost microscopic. I get the feeling that now that people are doing a lot of event store processing and message queuing, they get this big hammer out, and whatever they're doing must be in a queue stream somewhere or another, and therefore it must be a type of event. I'm concerned here because I think we're confusing actually the platform with the activity going on. And by doing that, frick, we're just making it more complicated for the next generation of coders. We're better than this. We've been down this route. Oh, hell, we've been down this route with Win32 message processing. So I just hate to see the industry go down this again. But this guy says, hey, there are three different types of this thing. What I really like seeing is one of those little quad charts. Upper left, upper right. You have to have one of those. So I can't give this guy props unless he has a little quad chart. And you also need one of those little circle diagrams for, like, you come in, you start doing something, at the end, you're back at the circle. Those are really cool, too. But other than that, it's a sort of classic article. I read something. I did it for a few years. Now I'm the expert. Speaking of, I did it for a while, now I'm the expert. This is a really cool tweet. It says, product strategy is simple. And I'm not recommending this because any of this material is any good, which is weird. It's just a great overview of different types of essays from different people in the product strategy world. It gives you, like, the best ways to do strategy, how to tell if it's working or not. I love people talking about this because it covers both the tech side, you know, how to create a SaaS, and the business side, how to do something useful. And I'm digging both sides of that just as much as each as much as the other. Vision versus strategy. I can guarantee you there's a little cycle diagram in there somewhere. Probably a bunch of little quad diagrams too, because you ain't doing what kind of Venn diagram. You ain't doing no kind of business talk unless you got diagrams. Hey, you got to have some PowerPoints. Anyway, that's cool. Cool stuff. If you're interested in product development, I recommend that you, along with me, go by there and look at all the different essays. Okay, so it seems like, and I'll give you the theme. It seems like the theme this week is that people come across these complex systems. They interact a bit, and they quickly establish in their minds this pattern that everything in the complex system must be like this. And then they write books and blogs and go on circuit or whatever. And many, many times they're completely wrong, but they're wrong in ways that are non-obvious and people can't pick out and explain why they're wrong. Here we've got nudge theory. And I've heard of nudging, leaning in, nudging. These are all business terms, become popular in the last decade or so. Nudge theory says that if you've got a system of people, say an organization, and everybody's taking a long lunch over an hour perhaps, and you want to change the system, you don't have to make radical changes. Instead, maybe at the end of the lunch period, if you come back on time, you get like a free candy bar. If not, you don't get the candy bar. You can add these tiny little incentives to complex systems and get people to act the way you want. You give them little nudges. Nudge theory is being used on everything from government programs to Facebook. They love nudging you, and they give you little rewards to do, like you're a little mouse in a trap, and they're feeding you little things, and you do the thing they want to do. So what this guy says, or these scientists say, is that, gee, dudes, if we're incentivizing people directly to act against their normal desires inside a system, we're not examining that system to begin with to determine why it's wrong. We're just like, hey, it must be screwed up. Let's give them stuff. And that's going to work for a while, but you're never going to figure out what you did wrong. You're never going to be able to change. And you're just going to end up with this really, really complex system of rewards that, like everything else, will stop working. This is a self-limiting way of doing stuff. It just kind of works now. And they're absolutely right. And at the end, they say, you know, we can do it both ways, but you got to start thinking about complex systems from top down as well as bottom up. You can't keep hacking away at complex, as any coder does. You can't keep hacking away at some little small part of a complex system and expect any good to come out of that. This next story is, who is behind QAnon? If you're not familiar with QAnon, and I'm not really that much, but as I understand it, QAnon is this kind of X-Files conspiracy theory for, I guess, right-wing folks. I don't know. If it's mysterious and the truth is out there and there's a conspiracy in the deep state, there's, I guess, a lot of really woo-woo type conspiracy things in here. Well, you can't do that anymore. You can't just throw out conspiracy theories anonymously. And the reason why is they go back with statistical text analysis, determine who you are. I don't think people realize really what the major change is. We have, for centuries, for our entire history of humanity, we've relied on people commenting anonymously, hey, things are really screwed up. And we let them do that because sometimes things are really screwed up. And you can't always come out publicly and say that. But guess what? Now, if you write enough, even under a pen name, they will figure out who you are. It brings up the example of J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter author. She actually wrote another book, Cuckoo's Calling, under a different name, and they went through and figured out that it was her that did that. It's just amazing to me. They're claiming 93%+ accuracy on guessing who it is. I wonder if we're not going to come up with, and if we don't have this, we should develop it, tools to re-anonymize our text. I guess it would go through and say, no, stop using this phrase over and over again, Daniel, because oh, this one tells us who you are. It's just, this bothers me as much as any other story this week. So yeah, this QAnon guy, hey, they're like, hey, it's you. He's like, no, it's not me. And it's, you know, all fun and games when it's like some conspiracy thing, but it's that's not at all where it's going to end. All right, this is, I think Diego sent me this one as well. Are you still using real data to train your AI? NVIDIA's Areb Blavarian says synthetic data can make AI systems better and maybe even more ethical. So big data is the new oil. Everybody has to have a bunch of data. They use this data to train systems. You got to have data. And they go, of course, get data from Google Images and maps and all this and social postings. But this guy's like, you know, why don't we just build a completely synthesized universe and then we have the AI train on it? And he's talking about modeling everything from atoms on up. This guy got, somebody got into the devil's lettuce at some point. I don't know how to do this. I know what he's saying. I actually like what he's saying. He's saying, you know, if nothing else, we can create a 3D kind of avatar-based world that we code these avatars to act as people do. And then we train the AI on that. And so then we're training, like, I don't know, if your car, you're training the car not to hit a walking biped, you're not accidentally training the car not to hit a walking white person, because that's not acceptable. You don't want the car to hit anything bipedal. And the only way you get to that is resynthesize or abstract out concepts and have the AI train on the abstract concepts. So I like this, actually, to a degree. But we're entering some kind of weird place in analysis and design where you're creating your own conversations with the computer that you don't really understand, and having the computer draw conclusions and act on it. I don't know what that is. That is not software engineering. That's not programming. I don't know what you call it. I don't know. It's somewhere between Mrs. Cleo Predicts the Future and Von Neumann machines. I'm not really sure where it is. I'm concerned that we're entering this area in an intellectual way that we don't have any concept at all what we're doing. This is the complex system. We work with it a little bit and make a big judgment and move forward. And this is a great example. Diego said, hey, well, what possibly could go wrong? And he's exactly right. We're just, hey, let's go get the bomb out and light the fuse and see what happens. I don't know how far we can continue going down this road of sort of this happy-go-lucky, optimistic, hey, it'll all kind of work out. It will all work out. I am very optimistic about the far future. But in the near term, dang, we've been shooting ourselves in the foot a lot. And this looks like another example of that. What could go wrong? Well, the following article, this is from Gizmodo. What is the most dangerous emerging technology? And the subtitles, what could go wrong? That soon we'll be able to write any virus genome from scratch. Yeah, so this is they polled a bunch of experts and said, hey, what do you worry about? And there are some things that can very, very likely go wrong. Private workplace surveillance. That's already happening. It's just going to get worse. Companies are going to tool up to follow you around at work and at home. This other guy had artificial intelligence. Remember, the main dangers of artificial intelligence is not Terminators. The main danger is that we start taking this AI stuff we're getting seriously as if it's telling us something new. It can very well be useful, but AI, what we're designing, hey, John, what we're designing basically is a bullshit machine. Let's hook you in, dude. I'm trying to capture the entire window. There you are. So, John, we're about halfway through so far.
All right. My meeting ended.
Yeah. Well, Greg said he was coming on to talk about this event article, and I don't know what happened. He ran away, I guess. I'm not sure. And Scott Ambler, last week, Scott emailed me in the middle of a meeting saying, hey, what's the link? So this week, I'm like, okay. So like at 2 o'clock, I said, yo, Scott, here's the link. He emails you back. Oh, I'm sorry. I can't make it this week. I'm not sure. I think he's like demonstrating this passive aggressive, like, I love you, but I can't come to anytime. You know, it's like, yeah, okay. Matter of fact, I emailed Scott 3 months ago. I said, Scott, dude, if you don't want to come, it's fine. He's like, no, I really, really want to come. I'm like, okay. It's like, I don't know. I don't know what to do. I feel like he's spending more time telling me he can't come than if he actually came one time.
Oh, boy. That's funny.
Yeah. And it's also ironic that he's the business process consulting guy.
Yeah. Life gets in the way sometimes.
So, what have you been doing this week?
Oh. Well. Stitching together some funny coincidences at work. And it's like suddenly a bunch of people are asking me questions about some value stream tool called Plan Deck that I've never used. Mm-hmm. So I got it, you know, I got attached, got an account, started looking at it. Yeah, it's like, oh yeah, well, John Kern should know about it. It's like, oh, value stream and metrics and all that crap he talks about. Surely he knows about it. Yeah, no. Yeah. So I've kind of just been, yeah, a little bit of something, looking into that to see if it's snake oil or if it certainly looks like something that would be valuable if you roll into a team and you're trying to help improve processes and you're talking, you know, you're preaching about value delivery and, you know, stuff that actually gets out, you know, not fake metrics, yeah, but sure. You know, some of the, like the stuff that I rip off out of the Accelerate book, those classic metrics. Oh, that would be cool to get something that's sucked in Bitbucket and Jira and whatever and turned it into something useful. So I'm just in the very beginning stages of seeing if it does what it purports.
So we've got story mapping. We got the Wordly mapping. We got traditional business process modeling in UML. We've got probably 4 or 5 other ways I've been exposed. Is this like a combination of all those? Are you drawing kind of little boxes and lines at some point, or how are they actually showing and manipulating that?
Yeah, I think it's more akin to, dare I say, a factory or something. But it really truly is more of what you might call a classic. Like we try to do this with teams. Sometimes you have Jira data. Sometimes you just, hey, forget the data. Just tell us what you think, you know, what your current process is, and just give us some relative estimates, maybe, because some teams can't, you know, don't want to give absolutes or, you know, or it's hard. And sometimes that's a sign that, wow, a lot of people don't actually know what their process is, do they? Okay, never mind, let's move on. We'll do it some other way. So it's actually kind of a, like if I went to our son's machine shop and worked with him, there would be some very discreet, you know, touch time.
So it's factory, factory station type model.
And things in between, wait time before it gets QA'd or before it gets, you know, or are you doing batch versus single piece? So it's very similar in my mind. It's exactly that. It's just sometimes you can divine it from Jira workflows. Sometimes there's stuff up front of Jira that you can get. So you can kind of, otherwise it's just talk to the people and have them guess at what timing is and what the delays are. Because a lot of times they can say, yeah, that usually sits on so-and-so's desk for 3 days. Okay, that's good enough. We'll write that down. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be exact science. But this tool, well, it's going to try to read exact data. And, you know, so on the surface, it would be, the interesting thing about a tool like this is, wait, you're not going to use those numbers to beat me up, are you? Oh, Yeah.
No, of course not.
Never. Right? So, you know, so part of me thinks, all right, maybe we don't sell it to people that are you know, command and control freaks and want to whip the ponies harder, as Ron Jeffries might say. Hmm. But if it's a team who really wants to do better, you know, and is looking for some metrics to kind of show where we're at and where we want to improve and then see some visible results, because I'll admit it is kind of hard to do it. I've tried it various ways, you know, manually with pieces in Jira and other things kind of half-assed. So anyway, yeah, just barely started looking at it.
That's sort of the qualitative versus quantitative discussion. They're kind of two paths to head down. Do you have numbers on something? Mm-hmm. It's a qualitative, quantitative. Do you like it or not? It's the qualitative. I decided to go down a qualitative route in my consulting. I know business folks love numbers. So the quantitative route is the one everybody heads down. Everybody wants to show you numbers. But I'll tell you why. I've had a bunch of stories like this, but one is I was working at a company that had split apart a team of like 10 or 15 guys to do startup type stuff. They had full control. They were developing and delivering apps on Android, iOS, and the web. And they said, hey, these guys are going to rock and roll. They want to bring in a tech coach. So I'm working with them. They're thinking, hey, they're telling me, hey, things really suck here. We're wasting a lot of time. And I go talk to the manager. He's like, no, things are fine. Because we gave them all this control. And I'm like, how can these two things be true? And I could have tried to sort of quantitatively figure it out. But instead, what I did right after, I think, a retro one day, I said, you guys all just guess for me how much time you feel like you're wasting interacting with a larger corporation that you could be delivering value. It was 90%. So, I mean...
Yeah, that's an unusual number.
Yeah, so there was a thing going on there that it, no matter what you see, if you... problem with numbers is with every number you have to define what the number is. And the way that bosses were defining the numbers were not the way that people were actually spending their time.
It is a kind of a fascinating topic. We could rabbit hole on for a while, yes. For sure. It's the other thing is, all right, hey, you know, we got the good delivery going, but are you delivering the right stuff? Right, so I have a lot of competing battles in my head about things like this, because to me, you know, in the small anyway, you should be able to make sure, and this is how I would typically work with teams, as long as we're working on the right stuff, I'm kind of pretty happy. Right. And, you know, we have some sense of vision, you know, but I'm not going to get all bent out of shape about scheduling out the wazoo, yes, because it's a waste of effort. Just make sure you have things in the right priority. And then do them at the right level at the right time. But that's really hard for a lot of people.
Yes. I think that any quantitative measurement, aside from like money or, you know, usage, any quantitative metric in the software development world is the sort of start down a road of diagnosis and charting, and it never ends well. You can get some really cool charts, though. But you say like, hey, ask if we're delivering value. That's a qualitative question. Are we doing this, yes or no? And one of the things that was interesting to me, I kind of ran across in the last year, is that when we say things are screwed up, we always do it in a vague way because we don't really know exactly why. It's like, hey, things really suck here. And that's fine. Saying things suck is a great way to start a job. We need to fix this, make it better. Just if you measure cycle time of requirements, 3 Amigo meetings. Well, you're saying, first of all, you have to have 3 Amigo meetings. Second of all, you're saying there has to be some cycle that's measurable. What you're really saying is you can't walk right into the team room with something you need done and have them work on it. I mean, that you're by putting that metric in place, you're actually constraining the value delivery of that team. And that may be fine, but they're having to live with it. You're just having to have a chart.
Right, and that's really important conversations to have, because it is, that's why I said it, you know, you're going to beat me over the head with this, because anytime any numbers pop up, you know, the typical response of a human is you think they're being judged. And unless it comes from within and the team wants to do it and the team embraces it, right, it's can be construed as a top-down, you know, bludgeon and a one-size-fits-all. What about the scenario you just described? Yeah, so that's why it's, to me, I'm always on the fence about things like this.
It's interesting because if you think about, we teach people, teams educate upwards from the bottom. We teach people to push the decisions down as close to the work as possible. If those things are true, and I believe they are, then management's job should be reactive. They're learning problems from the floor, and they're reacting to try to help it. But you tell that to a manager, like, no, I'm supposed to be proactive. I have to take... We teach people right from the get-go. No, you can't be... You have to be proactive. Like, no, stop. I do not need you coming in, like, fixing problems that exist in your mind, right?
Yeah, and that gets back to my goal is to, in many cases, get the thought bubbles above people's head about the direction we're going in the vision, whether it's for a feature, you know, or a big epic-y thing, or the whole product. It's really, you know, if you want folks to be engaged, you need to help show them what it is we're looking for, and so they can use their brain, give them the space to make safe experiments, let them be autonomous, and you know, autonomous does, you know, with autonomy without a goal is probably chaos, unless they have their own internal goal that happens to match the company's. But yeah, I mean, the idea is if I let folks know what this feature is supposed to do, this is what done might look like, and this is where I'm after, this is the outcome. The phrase I often use is outcome. Mm-hmm. What outcome do you want from this? More subscriptions, a happier user experience, or literally, you know, more PDFs generated, whatever. That's the goal. How do we get there? Let the team help you. Don't be the, you know, I've got to tell them what to do. I, you know, without me, they couldn't do it. You know, that's a way to work, but it's not a very good way to work.
The best, you as a writer, I keep trying to come up with little phrases that have impact. The best way I can think of this is that good teams are problem-solving machines. And so as the external organization, we want to give them problems to go solve because they're like miracle workers with problems. The more we try to solve the problem before it gets to them, the more we're actually making their job miserable and keeping them from doing the good work.
Yeah, and the phrase I use is a lot of folks do way too much detail, way too far in advance of when it's actually needed. And, you know, like I've seen people mock up adding a new field to a UI.
Yes. Yes.
I'm like, yo, you just need to tell the, you know, like, are your devs stupid or what? Of course they're not. Stop doing that. That's just some, well, I'm the UX designer. Well, screw it. Don't do mediocre, menial work that's got no value, but they don't understand because they don't understand who's receiving it. I just put, like, anyway, stuff like that is mind-numbing to me.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a culture.
It's back to the reactive, proactive thing. See, if you view UI design as being a reactive thing, you're sitting with the customer, they're working the thing, they have a problem, you react to it, then you really don't have a job description aside from make this thing work okay for the customer so they love it. But if you're thinking proactive, you're like, hey, I've got this book, I went to this seminar last month, I know what to do no matter what the customer wants. It's like, so I know I will be busy, my stash report will have items in it, you know, I will do what they want me to, and it has jack shit to do with your exit airport delivering some value somewhere or another. And how do you untrain people to that? I mean, once you've done that for even a month, it's the dickens trying to get it out of them.
Yeah, I think you have to, I mean, I've done it with you know, teams and organizations in small parts where sometimes it's having a relatively open conversation with somebody about, yeah, we really don't, when we need you, it's for the hard problems. I don't need you for these simple things, right?
Yeah.
So I think sometimes it's, you know, it's some weird, it's the over-engineer, it's the thinking of what we do like we're a machine or some engineering, and there's gears and there's, you know, this thing, you know, it's like a Rube Goldberg that, you know, some ball falls down and, you know, goes through something, it triggers something else, you know, and that's not, I mean, you can treat it that way, but a much better way is just how we're talking, is to you know, to lift off the shackles of over control and thinking of it like it's a factory,
yes,
and cogs, you know.
Yes, It's weird that it's thinking the factory metaphor. We think of being a chess master of process. I've had people say, I want to have this process documented. You know, and in their mind, they have this imaginary castle full of processes that they've addressed every worry. But it's really more like being a rabbit. I mean, if you're a rabbit in a field somewhere, you don't know what will go wrong, but you damn know sure something's going to go wrong. And so you keep your ears open, you're looking around, you're kind of being nervous all the time. You know, there is no process book for being a rabbit. It's just you worry about shit and you fix problems when you find them. But yet we would never, you know, it's like we automatically think, no, there has to be some system, of course.
And you have a great way to, you know, the mean time to restore. So you have lots of babies so that when you get killed.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Prepare to die. Worry about shit. Prepare to die. You know, the species wants to go on. Cool stuff. This next article is Misidentifying Talent. We had some long articles this week. This is around a conversation I was having. People were trying to... Have you ever seen the movie Moneyball? In Moneyball, what they did was they took a bunch of stats and tried to create teams and manage teams just around stats. And this is that sort of quantitative versus qualitative decision that we had. And John is either being very, very still, or we've lost John. I'm assuming you lost him. This guy gives this long list of how they do baseball. This is a misidentifying talent. If you've ever seen the movie Moneyball, this is right now what we're talking about. It's like, okay, you can actually create tech teams by running the numbers on the teams the way you would play a fantasy football or whatever else. So, fascinating. This gets down to hiring and evaluation, really gnarly subjects, but it's the same. I was talking to somebody online. Oh, it was somebody on LinkedIn. Some friends of them built a statistical project team system. And so they take, I don't know what stats, from each developer, I suppose, and then create these sort of fantasy teams that mix up developers. And then they throw, like, statistical projects at them, just like you play fantasy football, and see how they react. That's just kind of, that's some crazy-ass shit. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that, man. It's like, wow.
Yeah, it's sort of, you had posted something in the Discus channel somewhere, of that interesting article from Sloan, MIT Sloan, about happiness and well-being and sort of ramifications about, you know, probably you hang around longer and you perform better on your job, right? Mm-hmm. And they even mentioned in that article about looking at, you know, measuring happiness during as part of the hiring process. Like, hire happy people. Yeah, if you can, all else being equal, pick the happy one. Yeah, which is a little bit counter to let's do this.
Did you see the article? I'm sorry, I didn't flag it. It was a couple weeks back, about the guy who offers a $5,000 bonus after you've been hired for 2 weeks to leave. And I was like, what the hell? But it actually makes sense. If you've been there 2 weeks, you know what the job is. Take the money. We'd rather have you leave now with the money and get the next person than, like, stay 6 months and make everybody. And I was like, well, that actually, wow. It's like bonuses to leave. But if you do that, if you can actually run a company that way, you're going to have people who love the job, who want to stay. I think it's be a cool experiment. I'd like to see how they turn out with this thing.
Yeah, that is fascinating, because we do organizational network analyses and you can kind of see the people in the periphery who don't have a lot of connections, right? It's like nodes, or, you know, who talks to who, and, you know, like, sometimes you can spot silos because, wow, look at that. Everything's apparently got to go through Jim.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and then the risk of some of the other nodes on the edges that aren't connected is attrition.
Yes.
Because they're alone. They're not well connected. And then if you marry that with, to your point, long tenure, you would, because if a lot of those people leave early on, that was a big waste. That was a swing and a miss.
Yes.
Expensive. So yeah, 5,000.
It's probably a good trade.
Someone self-identified. As long as nobody comes and just uses that as a technique to earn $5,000.
So just this, I want to bring together these last four articles, Greg. Let me bring these four together because it makes such a cool story. We talked about qualitative, quantitative measurement process, how I kind of prefer qualitative. You were looking at this tool that did a lot of quantitative stuff. We talked about Moneyball, like using all these stats to simulate software projects, which is wild. And then you just brought the node analysis communication tool and how you can look at node analysis and trip people at the end. This guy wrote an article, Real Me and Fake Me. Basically what happened was he had somebody say, hey, you know, I really love your Instagram. Watch it every day. He's like, well, that's amazing. I don't have an Instagram. Goes to Instagram. He's got an Instagram. And so it's being updated every day with his stuff. And it the guy says he's him. And so he contacts the guy. He says, hey, you know, I'm pretty sure you're not me since I'm me. the guy gives him his number and says, no, this is a complimentary thing. So he follows his fake doppelganger for a while. And this leads this path. And then the guy about every month or 6 weeks or so takes on a new fake persona of a semi-famous person, runs a content with their name on it. And then at the end, it all ends up in some kind of blog for, hey, you need to buy this cryptocurrency by this crypto expert who is also a fake person.
Funny.
But
your response. How did I know this?
You know, so here's my question, okay? So if everybody's working remote now, okay, and we're doing a quantitative measurement of, you know, did you do 7 or 8? Why don't you just, like, arbitrage all your work? Who cares if it's you or not, man? You can pay somebody to get your email, to do all the stash reports, create all the numbers that look good.
Hold on. I'm going to take a very different perspective here. If I'm the employer, why do I fucking care?
Well, you don't care if you've got a good value stream. If you have focus on value, you don't care. But what we're talking about is employers... Managers don't know how to freaking run managed software projects. The real problem here, we do not know how to manage technology development. And because we don't, we create all this fake bullshit that makes us feel like we do. And then we create a bunch of waste, and then we bring in guys like us who say, well, you're all fucked up. But yeah, you're exactly right, Greg. If you're actually doing something that's useful, who cares? Just get it done.
Hey, if you manage to arbitrage a local guy in your neighborhood... was willing to do it for $2,000 a month cheaper and you're putting $2,000 in your pocket, I'm fine with that.
Well, yeah, I'm fine with that too. It reminds me of that Hacker News story, I think it was a month or two back. It was like, he took a remote-only job and then he automated all the work and then he took another remote-only job. He's like, he thinks he can get to 3.
Wow. That's funny. And the challenge there is to put little random things in there so it still seems like a human's doing it. I don't make it too perfect.
Oh, yeah, exactly, yeah. You want to put some little noise in there.
Right.
I'm imagining the main one that you would want to focus on there is actually time.
Time on task?
Not necessarily errors that are coming. But the time that occurs.
Yeah. Make it look human.
Yes. Right.
My father-in-law, yeah. My father-in-law has a store. He used to work in the nuclear industry. And they wanted people to identify what they were going to do the next week. And then the following week, they would report. This sounds very familiar to you, they report what they did or not.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he had a friend who, he figured out the system. And what he did was he just worked a week ahead. And then whatever he's already done, he claimed he would do that for the following week. And then so every week, he was like, nailed it every time. He was like, bam, bam. He was awesome. Like, hey, Jim's.
Yeah, you just have to work hard for 1 week, maybe 2 weeks worth of work. Then you're good.
Yeah, as long as you can stay a week ahead of time, you're fine. It's like every week, you're in the most accurate forecast ever.
That's funny.
This next article...
Yeah.
Go ahead. You're going to say something about the working.
I was just going to say, humans can be really, really clever.
Yeah.
We can game lots of systems.
Yes. You make a system, somebody's going to game it. Guaranteed. I'm gonna give me a second here. I'm going to see if I can actually... Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I can. I'll be danged. Do it like that, and I can go over here.
By the way, there's a salient point here of when you're building such a system to assume that's going to happen.
Yeah, Yeah, we can only understand things like John was saying earlier. You know, we have to have some kind of definition in numbers, or we can't understand it at all.
Let me give a concrete example. Let's imagine that we were building a gambling system. Now, we can be reasonably confident that there are going to be people who are trying to game our system. So,
yes.
At the very beginning, what we should be doing is saying that we are going to set aside some amount of money for people who have gamed the system.
Yes.
And reward them,
yes.
Not punish them.
Yes, the industry's been doing this for probably a decade or more, the software industry. Yeah, you break into Facebook.
Really?
You break into Facebook, you get like $10,000, or maybe more. You get paid. You just say, hey, I broke into your system. Here's how I did it. They give you a check. You're happy. They're happy. You know, it's a good work. Because it's probably cheaper to pay the assholes to hack into your system than it is to pay the experts to fix the system for being hacked into.
Right. That's clever. That's smart. Yeah. You're at least rewarding somewhat semi, you know, like good people for finding a bug doing nefarious things, but at least they're doing it at the
well, and the thing is they actually found it.
Yes, and they're better at it than the experts are every time, by orders of magnitude.
What's really shitty about this though is when you run into companies that say that they offer this and then you provide one and then they renege on it.
Oh, well, that's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
bad. And they go, well, yeah, you were able to take... I ran into this with Uber. You were able to take rides that we could not associate back to your account, but that doesn't really represent a bug.
Well, one time when I was at TogetherSoft, some guy, so we, you know, we had Russian developers. I'm in St. Petersburg. We had a small team in Moscow, but somebody sends in a bug about some really esoteric translation language thing in the editor. So this is a UML modeling tool with a code editor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they're deep in the bowels of this one part of the app that's, yeah, you know, frankly, we're not like an IDE, and diagrams are second. You know, to us, the diagram is the holy grail, and the code editor is second. Well, I remember saying to my colleagues, I was like, wow, this dude freaking, because we had obfuscated code, so it wasn't like it was in the clear. He figured, not only did he find the bug, he reverse engineered our obfuscated code and told us how to fix it. And I'm like, why don't you go talk to this guy? Maybe we should hire him. Because, you know, so it's a little bit like he didn't, you know, he didn't ask for money, you know, but it's like, wow, holy cow, this guy, I don't know how his freaking mind works, but that's insane that he found the problem and then reverse engineered obfuscated Java.
And he would be motivated to do that, that you know, that somehow this problem was bugging him so much.
I think you're right, because it was a fix and he was happy. Yeah, he said, here. This did bug the shit out of him, and I could care less about the bug, but it was funny.
We have literally run into this with Event Store, where we will end up with clients coming and saying, hey, we found this security issue, and here's a patch for it. And it's like, well, thank you, client. We should probably do something for you as well.
Yeah.
I think one of the mistakes I made as a consultant many years ago, I was working for Pitney Bowes, And they had a startup prototype that they had ran to production. Of course, that never happens. And so the thing was a piece of crap, and it couldn't scale, but they were determined to scale it. And so I was brought in to run the existing team that was quite upset that they were trying to scale it, and hire a new team and also set up process. So I was doing a bunch of shit. But anyway, the problem was the old stuff was crap, and the team knew it was crap. And they were like, this is going to break forever. We need to put the new system in place for as soon as possible, even if it's not any features. Well, management kept coming to me saying, oh, why is this broken? Why is this old system broken? And finally, one day, I'm like, it's broken because it's a piece of shit. It needs to die. It's like, I am not, to your point, I am not concerned that this piece of shit is actually a piece of shit, because I knew this. This is, I know you're upset about this, and I'm sure it's a big deal to you, but you can't change what it is simply because you're really concerned about it. Unless you're a coder, in which case you go into Java and fix it. This is called the death of process, this next one. Is to write great policies, arm
by
those...
By the way, I'm just curious. Have either of you guys ever worked on a team where you actually prioritize bugs in terms of your ability to work on them based on their associated cost?
No. I know what you mean. I've worked with organizations that have done that, but when I've coded, we do it or we don't do it. It either exists, we're fixing it now, or forget it.
Well, no, yeah, so...
But there's a formalization.
Yeah, so I will say, Greg, the answer is, yeah, what I do is, it depends, of course, how egregious the bug is. So, you know, if it's a... I use the term my wife uses, like a coffee stain, you know, like... When you walk into a nice place and there's just a coffee stain, could you just spend a little time cleaning, wipe that up, right? You know, and it's so much better. So, you know, some of those things are usually pretty simple to fix, but they have no material harm, so to speak. But, so I will use the cost of fixing and the likelihood,
yes,
sort of the likelihood of this thing occurring and the damage it can cause, just to say yay or nay.
We do, yeah, low, medium, high. Would you do like the low, medium, high, or?
Yeah, but I also factored in, because sometimes, like, this was an Ice Cube's chance in hell. Like, the next time the moons of Jupiter are aligned with Pluto, this is going to happen again. I'm going to wait for it to happen again. Yeah. I'm not going to fix it, right? Like, sometimes they're so weird that I don't bother fixing them. Yeah, so I would say I have a blend. I don't just, if it was cheap, I still don't just fix it.
Right. Oh, it's reproducibility. For me, it's reproducibility, it's impact, and it's a time to fix. Yeah. So if it's reproducible, high impact, doesn't really matter how much time you have, and you do those in charts. This drives directly to earlier thing. When I work teams, I don't do that, because the reason I don't do that is because once you start focusing on that spreadsheet, you are no longer delivering value. You're creating some little castle in the sky. Now, I made these for customers as I run a team. Fuck yeah, you want a chart, I'll make you a damn chart. We'll keep a list of shit, but not actually use that for development. I've never seen a system of bug tracking that didn't turn into sort of a bear for everybody involved. It wasn't just a whiteboard or a quick list. And I work with some large organizations. It's just, it becomes its own thing. Greg, have you seen one that worked?
I have seen one that's worked, and it was quite interesting. So the one that I've seen that worked, it was internal, and it would allow you to assign budget to a bug being fixed.
Yeah, we could do the portfolio thing. I wish Scott were here, because this is project chartering, because at some point your bugs can be grouped into projects. You can charter a project with a budget, or you can budget down to the item level. You can also, I've seen it done where you want to go down to the user story level, and you've got a system for prioritizing stories with a budget for each story. There's no end to the amount of slicing and dicing you can do. It just it becomes kind of
complicated. But the great thing about it is that I've also shed all blame. We went and we did that. Why did you do that? Well, because customer 123 said that's what we should fucking do.
Yeah.
and they paid us to do it. If you disagree with that decision, we're happy for you to pay us to take a different decision.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what you're actually talking about, getting the budget from somewhere else, not doing the chart and assigning your own budget, right?
Correct.
Now that's a little, I don't know.
Let's take an example where we have external customers. Now, you think bug A should be fixed before bug B. The person who has bug B said they're going to pay us $5,000 to make sure that bug B is fixed before next Tuesday.
Ooh, bug auctions. Ooh, I like this. I like where you're going with this.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to make bug B prime as I fix bug B.
Oh, yeah.
That is a possible negative incentive.
Yeah.
But you get money.
Charging customers to fix their bugs.
That's a good one. Yeah.
You're not charging them to fix it. You're charging them to prioritize it.
Right. Yeah, you are. That's correct. You're not. You're going to fix it no matter what. It just where it appears in the list.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I often say you never want to be on, you know, some dependency on someone else's roadmap.
You know, I wonder if you could do that. Yeah, I wonder if you could do that internally with a corporate team. So you just charge another cost center. So they say, hey, this is broken.
I would imagine it would still work. But the main thing is, it also values things from that other person's perspective.
Yeah, that's why I like it so much. I was going to tell
so
the story.
Like, if you want us to fix this and you want it fixed by Monday, we'll do that.
Yeah.
But it's going to cost you an extra grand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the things I have seen over and over again working on bug tracking systems is, you know, the poor lady in Topeka who wrote this bug ticket because her boss told her she had to write it, and it's been a year and a half, and it's like item 173 on your list. And Greg's thing here would be like, hey, you know, needs fixing, boss, pony up the money. Like, yes or no?
Well, and this also helps you because it makes a market.
I like it a lot. I this is one of the coolest things we've talked about. I think this is really, really cool. This could change a lot of stuff.
Could I, as an example, I've got a rather large number of Twitter followers. If I found a bug in Git, push on all my Twitter followers, that my Twitter followers should all vote on it and maybe donate $1 each in order to get it fixed.
Hmm. I don't know if it would work. I don't know. Why not?
Why don't you send that our way first, and we'll do the lobbying for you.
So we got a couple more articles. This next one is, this guy says he used to process, and he knows all about process, the master of process. This nice lady. A lot of blah, 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 hand waving. At the end, the good part is, don't write a process that you're not able to and willing to describe when it should die. I like that. That was the good part. The bad part was this assumption that there's all this other stuff in
it. Yeah, it is interesting, because on school boards, a lot of what you try to do is actually drive most things through policies. So they say the word process, but also he says, I see that, you know, so when I write a policy. So this has to be thinking along those lines, because sometimes the things that I try to kill in the policies are duplication, you know, things that are ambiguous. And this will make me think along the lines of, yeah, do some of them need to have sunset rules or expiration rules?
I like, we've talked about in the United States having sunsetting all the laws. And I like that idea a lot because, at the very least, you should describe when it should die, because things have to die. But, you know, even better, have them reconsidered every 5 or 10 years and see if it's still working. So we'll drop the guys for a minute or so, and we'll continue on. This next article is, their bionic eyes are now obsolete and unsupported. And this made me very sad. Okay, so Barbara Campbell was walking through New York City subway, And all of a sudden, she stopped being... So this next article, guys, is their bionic eye.
If not clear, I actually cited a real law.
Okay. I'm sure.
It is literally illegal to sing in the bathtub.
I have done this, and I don't... You guys don't rat me out, right? Because I'm that guy. I've sung in the bathtub many times.
As long as you're not doing it on the podcast, it's probably okay.
That's a different podcast. It's a different... You don't want to go... Okay, so this next article is their bionic eyes are now obsolete and unsupported. This lady, Barber, something or another, she's walking through the subway, and suddenly she can't see. And the reason she can't see is her bionic eyeball has now been deprecated, no longer supported. So she went from being able to see sort of vaguely lights and shadows to being blind again. It's like, frack. What do we? This is not, you know, this isn't, hey, that was an error, my Russian's wrong on the Java. This is, the lady could see a little bit, now she can't. Yeah, I was very uncomfortable reading this, and you know, as we talked last week, programming isn't just like Donkey Kong no more. We're getting some, doing some serious stuff out there, and I don't know how you fix this. I guess every software interaction with people has to be registered or something, so maybe they can't. I don't want this happening again. This is important. We're hurting people.
Well, yeah, I know. What was the phrase we used? In like the centrifuge, you know, a 50-foot arm centrifuge that can you know, do 42 G's, you know, it could kill you. But yeah, like man rating and yeah, like the fail safe and yeah, I mean, other equipment I think has designs around the, you know, this sort of thing that is kind of interesting. I assume it wasn't like mass produced. I assume, was it very prototype?
She'd had it for about 15 years, and this is not a case where it broke. This is a case where it worked okay, and she had actually became a spokesman for this company. I guess they didn't sell enough eyeballs or something, so they went broke, and now her eye don't work no more. Her eyes.
Yeah.
Messed up stuff. Okay, final article. Dead. Final article. He says to himself. Lady of Spain, I know you. Okay. The curse is upon us, my friends.
No, because then Mars would get all the good innovations.
This next article is Dad takes down the entire town's internet by mistake because his kids stay online too much. he buys a signal jammer. Takes down the whole town.
That's funny.
Your kids had better straighten up. Take down the town's internet again. They're like, all the people in the town, yeah, they're doing stuff, and all of a sudden the whole thing goes down. They're like, what the hell? The Simpsons kid have been bad again.
That's really hilarious. I had no idea you could do that. Well, I guess you're not supposed to.
No, it's not recommended. So what have you guys been consuming this week? Books, movies, TV shows?
I'm still reading just about 3/4 of the way through a little book on dumbing us down. So it's still a interesting read from a 30-year veteran of New York public teaching, very highly rated, you know, rewarded or awarded and stuff like that. But he's completely against some of the things that turned it into factory education, right? It's just like a factory software team. There's that overprocessing and treating things like, you know, we're engineering and we're fungible and you can just stamp out features or you can stamp out kids at the cost of killing community and killing, you know, does it sound familiar? Killing collaboration. Except it's worse than just software. You know, he's talking about kids and people, and, you know, the loss of community and the loss of family.
There's a lot of similarity there. An amazing amount. I have a friend who went into, she started teaching, became a principal, went into administration. We can't manage education, just like we can't manage technology projects. It is very, very rare to see any sort of large system of education that doesn't fall in this kind of bullshit trap you're talking about.
Yeah.
I finished up Citizens, the book about French Revolution. The wife and I started watching this HBO Max Stephen King miniseries, The Outsider. Most excellent. If you want a scary miniseries to watch, I recommend it. And then I've started watching this TV show from Australia called Harrow over lunch, which is just sort of Quincy with an Australian accent, just background noise. Greg, you been reading any books, seeing any movies or anything?
I have been. I've been on a trend for a while. I've been reading Vonnegut.
Oh, whoa.
Slaughterhouse-Five.
Oh, that is one of many.
Yeah.
Beckett Wright.
He's really fun.
Here's a weird thing that happened to me. So, I don't know if I've told this story before. I'm working at Ohio State Parking, you know, for the parking authority. Sometimes driving around, other times in the booth, taking tickets, right, and money and that kind of thing as people change classes. So I'm in a booth, and it becomes very, like, you become like an automaton. You take something, you put it in the machine, you say a number, you get money, right? I mean, it's next, and you just do this over and over. And then you sit back down as classes start, right? And then there's a big wave, right? So someone pulls up. I look down. He hands me a card. My visual processor rejects it. I give it back. He goes, oh, and he hands me the right one because they looked almost the same. I put it in the machine, finish transaction, and as he's pulling out, my brain processes what this card was. Remember those old wooden card catalogs that just had a single hole in the bottom of the card for each book?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It was one of those, like, you know, about the same size as... And it was by a book by Kilgore Trout. And I remember going, wait, because I thought Kilgore Trout was a character in a Kurt Vonnegut book who's an author. And then I started wondering, like, did he write a book? Is it a pen name? Is it? Anyway, that's my Kurt Vonnegut story.
And you remember that to this day. Yeah, this has been like a while back, right?
Oh, this was in the late 70s.
Wow.
Early 80s. Yeah. Whenever the hell, somewhere around there when I was at school. Yeah, so it was just a really funny, like, how my brain worked. It was like post-processing, you know, the video. Like, I just rejected it because it wasn't, the form factor was wrong, but I still read it. And I think that I've also done things like turn pages and then go, wait, and I turn back because I spotted a typo, but I didn't read it. So I think there's this weird thing in my brain.
No, it's weird because this past week, my wife was explaining something to me. I can't remember what it was. But she explained something to me, and I said, oh, you mean X? And she's like, no, it's Y. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry I misunderstood you. Well, the next day, this happens again. I said, hey, it's X. And I'm like, wait a minute. It's not X. And so I remembered the wrong way. I remembered it was wrong, but I still couldn't remember what Y was. She's like, no, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I knew that. And the thing is now that she brought it up, I remember the whole thing, but I made a bigger impression on the wrong thing than the right thing. Sounds like you kind of did the same thing.
Yeah. It's like if you go the wrong way to somebody's house, it's like you're probably going to do it again the second time.
Yeah, I remember getting off an elevator on the wrong floor. It was a building that all the floors were similar. It was a freaky experience, and I got off the elevator a million times. I remember that one 20 years later. So, Greg, what are you reading from Vonnegut?
Oh, Vonnegut, I just enjoy reading in general. Have you read any of his essays?
I think so.
No.
They don't come to mind. I did read a speech he did, but that's the smallest thing. Slaughterhouse-Five was great.
Well, yeah, Slaughterhouse-Five is great. Did you know that he also has an essay named Slaughterhouse?
Mm-mm. Did I know that?
The main point in it is that people do not realize that they are happy.
I would agree with that. I would completely agree with that. People go through the best times in their life moaning and complaining because they're people who like moaning and complaining, and then they look back and go, holy shit, that was the best time of my life.
Okay, so yeah. you're gonna laugh at this, but do you want to know the example that he used?
Sure.
Software programmer.
No, it was his experience when Dresden was being bombed.
Oh, my God.
That was a horrible...
Yes, like, firebombing in Dresden, yes. That was war crime.
It was like just a firestorm.
You'd be considered a terrorism act. Yeah. He was happy then? I was happy. They killed all those people, but I was happy then.
That's... I'm not going to put it quite in those words, but it's not too far off from what he was saying.
Yeah, that reminds me of... there have been several books written about the POW experience in Vietnam. And the senior ranking officer was a stoic and a kind of an amateur philosopher. He managed to stay happy through his confinement, using stoicism, and everybody else admired him for like being on the level. Matter of fact, that guy was the vice presidential candidate with Ross Perot, if you remember, years and years ago. That was the guy.
Navy guy.
Yeah.
Admiral something.
Yeah, he did not look good on TV, but he was most admired by everybody I worked with. He looked awful when it was terrible, but smart guy.
Saturday Night Live, right? Like one time they like kicked him out of the car and he's like running after the car.
Yep. Come on, drive faster.
Yeah, that was back in the good old days when Saturday Night Live actually made fun of all kinds of people.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
John McWhorter had a podcast this past week about how the TV was actually much more progressive in the 70s and 80s than it is now, which is true, but it's really, really weird. One of the examples I brought up, I actually sent John an email. There was a 1976-77 skit with Chevy Chase and Richard Pryor. And like most funny skits, the two people have these obsessions that they're not willing to give up, but they won't tell the other person, so they just go back and forth. And Richard Pryor has to get the job. You're a wonderful interviewer. I love this place. Have to get the job. And Chevy Chase is this horribly racist person who doesn't want to admit he's racist. And so it starts like a normal interview, and Chase asks sort of an off-color racial remark. And Pryor just kind of goes, oh, thank you. And they ask a bigger one, and then he just starts just pounding them with all these horrible things. Pryor's like, oh, that's fine. That's good. I'm good. Funny as shit, but you could not do that today. It just would not work.
Yeah, it's like Blazing Saddles. Is
oh, my God. It's hilarious.
They should play that. I mean, it's that kind of, you know, that I think helps.
Oh, my God. It shows that we can have a conversation about race where make fun of ourselves and others.
There's another great example of this. If you go back, not even that far ago, in Living Color.
Mm. Oh, that was a good show, too. Very good show.
Today, yeah. It would probably be shut down. It would be shut down.
It would. Really? You're right. I think part of the problem is shows like that are too easy to pull little clips out and generate random outrage about them. And we live in a very silly time, actually. It's incredibly trivial.
Now, who is the crackhead character?
That was one of the Wayans brothers. What did it have to be? All messed
it
up.
Was one of the Wayans brothers.
He was hilarious. Oh, my God. And he appeared in one of the first Scream movies, too, if you remember that guy. Funny guy. Funny. Those funny brothers. Oh, that's hilarious. I reminded me of Blazing Saddles, where the sheriff holds himself hostage. he pulls the gun and he's, are you serious, man? You might shoot.
Right. Yeah, so he can escape the mob. Yeah. And he backs up and yeah.
And you can't talk about Blazing Saddles without talking about how the dang movie ended. they switched to this dance routine in this Hollywood musical. And it's obvious that there's some flaming homosexuals doing the gangster movie. It's all the Western people that get in this fight, and then the set falls down, and they actually go to this next movie and start beating up all the dancing people. Funny. Yeah.
Just so as a reference, I pulled it up. So the character we're discussing is actually Anton Jackson from In Living Color. One of the best episodes you can watch is Anton Jackson at Court.
Oh, okay. I can see what we'll be watching after this show.
Yeah, put the link in Discus.
Yeah, we'll do. All right, guys, let me do my goodbye thing. It's 20 after here. Hang on. Well, dang. We didn't take a half hour. We took almost an hour and a half. You have lost an hour and a half of your precious time. You could have been studying to be a brain surgeon. You could have been watching Harrow and Living Color. There are more useful things to do with your life, my friends. But we're happy you dropped by. We had a lot of fun. We hope you did, too. Please come by Discord. You're welcome to join in the conversation, type in comments and questions, and we'll even bullshit you for answers most of the time. DanielBMarkham.com. I am Daniel Markham. I will see you on the internet. Hey, guys.